Hey there, mama. You're listening to the Lift the Shame podcast. I'm your host, Crystal, mama of five and your family's intuitive eating dietitian, here to help you cut through the diet culture clutter so you can enjoy freedom with food as a family. I'm on a mission to help you end the generational legacy of diet culture in your home so you can experience motherhood free from food guilt and body shame. Listen in weekly for guidance on how you can ditch diet culture, heal your relationship with food in your body, and confidently raise intuitive eaters. Let's dive in and lift the shame together. Hey, mama, welcome back to the show. I am so excited to dive into another topic with you this week. And at the time of this recording, it happens to be Eating Disorder Awareness Week. And I am going to be talking today just about some things that we can do as parents to help decrease our child's risk of developing an eating disorder. And I know that this is a topic that's near and dear to your heart as it is to mine. And I've shared a little bit about this on the show here and there, but I myself struggled with an eating disorder in my late teens and early 20s, and am thankful to have had over a decade of recovery under my belt, and at the same time, recognize just the many different fears and challenges that being a parent can bring when you've had an eating disorder history. No matter how long or short your journey has looked like, if you have struggled with an eating disorder, I understand the real fears that you may have when it comes to parenting your own child. And I know for a fact that you want to do everything in your power to help prevent your own child from struggling with some of the things that you may have dealt with when it comes to food and your body. And so today I'm hoping that we can just dive into some key cornerstones, so to say, when it comes to building your family's food culture and creating this foundation in your home that can really help support your child to developing a lifelong positive relationship with food and their body. First, I want to just address a couple things about eating disorders in general, because I think there tends to be a lot of misconceptions, a lot of stigma wrapped around these conditions, and a lot of shame. You know, like, unfortunately, they are very misunderstood. And I think for a lot of us as parents who may have had this history, or even if you're currently struggling, it can be really hard to talk about what's going on for you because it feels so misunderstood. And I hope that this feels like a space where you can begin to explore some of these things free of shame and really begin to shed light on these areas in your life that matter to you, that have been part of your story and your experience. Because I truly believe that when we can start to alleviate ourselves from the shame that we carry, it really allows us to heal. And as we heal and become more whole as parents, you know, we can show up for our kids in many different ways and very powerful ways too. And one thing that I think is a common theme here is this idea that eating disorders can somehow be prevented. And that is why I'm very careful with wording. And so, for example, for the purpose of this show, talking about ways that we can decrease our child's risk of potentially developing an eating disorder, not prevent the risk altogether. And, you know, I think part of this is understanding what is within our realm of control as parents and understanding what's not in our control. And that comes with looking and examining at the nature of eating disorders, first of all, as a condition itself. And it's important to understand that these conditions are psychosocial in nature and also influenced by biological underpinnings, meaning that there are biological factors that will influence a chance of developing an eating disorder. And what that means is that, you know, there is a genetic component connected to eating disorder development. And I know hearing that can sometimes feel painful in a lot of ways, because essentially that means there is a part of this that we can't control. We can't determine the genes that our kids are allotted or the genes that our kids get. The reality is that family history does play a role in our child's risk of developing an eating disorder. And I know I don't want to come across as a Debbie Downer or anything like that, but just to present the reality of these conditions, understanding that there is a component that is outside of our control. And with that being said, though, it's important, again, to kind of remove some of this unnecessary pressure off of your shoulders. Because I think sometimes, especially if you have struggled with an eating disorder or who have had a family member that has struggled with food in this way, again, you may be so driven and motivated to do everything in your power to prevent your child from potentially dealing with some of these same things. And that is enormous pressure to put on your shoulders. And it can almost be suffocating. Like, you might feel like you're under a microscope and every single thing that you're doing is going to make or break whether or not your child develops an eating disorder. And I just want to give you permission to remove that pressure from your shoulders, because it can be so unnerving. Sometimes it might prevent you from actually living or engaging with your child in a meaningful way because you're so scared of breaking them. And in a way, that's a trauma response. That's you know, part of you responding from your own fear or from your own trauma around food in your body. And again, like, you want to do everything to protect your child, and that is such a brave thing to do. And it's also important to understand, okay, what is in the realm of my control and what is not. And when we look at the nature of eating disorders, we have to realize that there is that genetic component. If you've had an eating disorder history, because of that, you know, or family history, that may increase your child's risk. But again, that is not going to be something that you're causing or that it's your fault if your child were potentially to deal with something like this. We have to understand that eating disorders are complex conditions and that they are influenced by a multitude of factors, many different things that kind of come together to create the perfect storm. And again, when we're talking about biological components, psychological, social, environment, right? There's just so many factors that are not in your control. And so I think the big thing that we can think of here is looking at it from a point of view where, what is within my realm of control? And then having awareness of potential, like, warning signs, like early things to be looking out for when it comes to eating disorder development, that can really arm you with information and resources to better help support your child should that be something that they struggle with. But just keeping this in mind, because again, I think as a parent, you may feel so burdened for your child or so scared about your child potentially struggling. It's easy to internalize that fear. It's easy to internalize anything that your child struggles with as your fault. And it's important to just give yourself grace for this journey and understand, again, eating disorders are very complex and there's many different factors at play. And just having more awareness about these conditions can really help support you and also give you greater awareness to potentially help your child. And that is an incredible thing, because early awareness, early intervention has been shown to drastically improve treatment and prognosis. And I think, you know, as parents, like, having that information available to you can be so life-giving in supporting your child in a meaningful way, should that be something that they potentially struggle with. Knowing that eating disorders are not parents' faults. And, you know, there's so much that we can do as parents to help support our kids. There's a lot that we can do, and that's within our realm of control to help decrease their overall risk. But then also understanding that, you know, because of the nature of these conditions, there is a chance that your child may struggle. And it doesn't mean, again, that that's your fault. And being informed about early warning signs can actually support you in better helping them down the road. I know for so many moms that I've worked with who have struggled with eating disorders, it was something that they were dealing with for multiple years before anyone knew anything was wrong, right? Like, so many of us struggled in silence. And that is because oftentimes the early warning signs of eating disorders are often hidden under this disguise of, you know, wellness or being healthy, or, you know, we lost weight, but we were praised for it. And nobody ever looked at that as an early warning sign. And so I just want to encourage you. I know there can be a lot of fear here, but I just want to encourage you that as a parent, like, you are being armed and informed. And through your own healing, you will be able to identify if there is something going amiss with your own child or if they are struggling potentially, and to be able to intervene early on to help support them in a positive way. So I just wanted to kind of start off that way, because I think, again, it's easy to internalize these things as our fault, or if my child were to struggle, that would be totally on me. And I just want you to be encouraged as a parent. Like, again, like, you're tuning into this podcast because you care about your child. You want to shift the culture around food in your home. And And also knowing like there's so many things that are out of our realm of control. But when we're able to create this foundation with our kids, it really does help support them in a positive way. And with that being said, I wanted to just share a few things here that really stuck out to me in terms of things that we can be thinking about in terms of, again, decreasing our child's overall risk of developing an eating disorder by supporting them in building a positive relationship with food and their bodies, one that really is built on this foundation of trust. You know, if you've been tuning into this podcast, you know I'm a big proponent of trust and facilitating trust in our children, which can help them internalize trust in their own bodies and in themselves, which will carry them so far and really functions as a protective mechanism in a lot of ways against many of the challenges that they may encounter in diet culture and, you know, in many different scenarios outside of our own homes. So I wanted to just share, I narrowed it down to 5. When I was originally kind of writing some notes for this episode, I had a huge page full of different things that we can do. And it just made me think too, like so often as parents, we're like, just give me the list, right? Like, give me the scripts, give me the game plan, tell me what I'm supposed to do. And I just, again, like as one parent to another, just want to encourage you and remind you that your intuition as a parent, the relationship, the unique relationship that you're forming with your child is going to take you so much farther than any script or formulation or framework. And to really, as you're hearing some of these things, like take them in a way that will support you and not make you feel like, man, I'm burning the candle from both ends here. Like sometimes we put all this pressure on ourselves of all these things that we feel like we should be doing or that I need to be doing. And that can be a quick fire way to burn out and stretch yourself beyond your capacity. So as always, as I'm sharing some of these ideas, like please, you know, do what you need to do to take care of yourself and just recognize that just you showing up for your child, just your willingness and desire to do differently for them, to show up in a way that is positive and supportive, like those things alone are so powerful and monumental in shifting the tide and shifting these cycles. And so please go gently with yourself as you're hearing some of these things and just know like this is not meant to be another laundry list of things that you need to do, but rather like ways to encourage you to grow, you know, naturally within the rhythms of your current family unit. So again, like take these things gently. And as always, I recommend like if there's one thing that sticks out to you, you know, maybe try focusing on one thing in particular. If there's one area that you feel like, ooh, that's like an area where I could use more support, you know, try to focus on one thing at a time. Because again, when we try to overwhelm ourselves by doing too much at once, it can sometimes backfire. And so I just wanted to encourage you with that. Again, especially for this topic, because again, so many of us are like, tell me exactly what I need to do to prevent my own child from ever dealing with the struggle that I've dealt with, because it's so real and it's so painful. And again, we want to protect our kids. And again, knowing you can do what you can do within your capacity and the way you're showing up for your child matters. And that alone is making a difference. So let's go through a few things here. I narrowed it down to 5. So the first one here that can be really supportive in terms of helping decrease our child's risk of developing an eating disorder is just looking at the culture around food in your home, food and bodies. And a huge step here that so many of you are working on is just shifting away from this dieting culture, right? This alone is so powerful and monumental. And so many of us grew up in dieting homes where we saw our parents dieting or we saw our caregivers dieting, or, you know, it wasn't unusual to have a scale in the bathroom or to hear parents talking about how much they weigh or how much they need to lose, or, you know, even seeing parents potentially struggling with eating disorders themselves. Like, these are all things that we are healing from and working to move away from. And it can be helpful to just kind of examine what is the culture in your own home around food and dieting. Are there still subtle ways that dieting is showing up? Is your child hearing about dieting in certain conversations or hearing you potentially talk negatively about your own body? That can be a hard one too. Do you still have a scale in your home? Are you weighing yourself? These are all things to just kind of examine, like, what are the subtle ways in which diet culture is showing up in your home? And I want to just clarify to you, like, we live in a culture that is submerged in dieting. Like, the dieting mindset is a message that's reinforced by our society. And so some of these subtle things that we may be holding onto in our homes may not seem like that big of a deal, right? However, when we look at like the subtle messages that our own children might be picking up when it comes to food or body, like it can be really helpful to kind of examine those subtle things. Or another way to look at this are, what are the messages or things that you picked up growing up just by observing how your own caregivers interacted with food and their bodies? Like, did your mom like ever come in the pool with you? Or did you ever notice your mom in a bathing suit? Or was your mom hiding her body in a lot of ways? Or, you know, did you see a certain caregiver skipping out on meals or not eating with you or eating something different, right? Like, what are the things that you remember about your upbringing around food? And are some of those things potentially showing up in your own food culture now with your own family unit? And again, I can't reiterate this enough, but just looking at yourself through a very compassionate lens and understanding that a lot of the behaviors that you have adapted around food in your body, a lot of them are serving a purpose in your life in some form or another. And so it can be hard to just say, all right, I'm going to do something differently today. It's not that easy, but it can start with self-awareness. It can start with awareness and curiosity about the culture of food, the culture of bodies in your own home, and asking yourself, like, where is diet culture still sneaking up in here? Are you only buying certain like healthified versions of food, or maybe diet foods, or maybe avoiding buying certain foods for fear of how your child might eat them? I'm just throwing out some common examples that I see and notice. But again, like, I just want to encourage you to look at through this through a very curious lens, and knowing that, you know, building a positive culture around food in your home, one that doesn't demonize food, one that celebrates all food and all bodies, and that really upholds perspective towards eating that doesn't revolve around dieting, is going to be so powerful for your kids in formulating that trust in their own bodies, which thereby can help decrease their risk of developing an eating disorder. So that's my first one there. Second one here to look at is the language or conversations that may be happening around your child's body or appetite. And this is tough because this can start at such a young age when our kids start hearing things like, oh, you're so cute, or, you know, I love how you dress. And like, again, these are societal standards, societal messages that reinforce this idea that the way our child looks or the size of their body is the most important thing about them. And unfortunately, that is not going to change in terms of societal differences, right? But what can change is the culture, again, that you're building in your home. And what are the conversations that you're having with your child about food and about their body? And one area where I see this come up a lot is discomfort around our child's body sizes and their appetite. So it's very easy to project some of our discomfort or things that we might be feeling about our child, especially if we feel like they're eating too much or they're eating too little, or we're uncomfortable with the way their body's changing. Or let's say you're noticing that your child's gaining a lot of weight and that is bringing up a lot of discomfort for you. What are you communicating, or what's the language, or what are the conversations that are happening? And ultimately, when we can refrain from having any comments about our child's body or appetite, that alone can be a huge protective factor for them, much more than we realize. And again, this doesn't mean that they won't potentially hear this from other people outside of our home, but at least in the context of our own home, if they can trust that their appetite is safe, that their body is safe, again, that's going to go a long way in protecting them and protecting their overall relationship with food and their body. It's going to be huge. And the reason for this is because our children, what they need most from us is unconditional acceptance around their bodies and their appetites. And when they hear comments from us about, you know, and it can be very subtle. It might not be blatant, obvious things, like subtle things, but our kids are smart and they pick up on these messages. And so when we are communicating mistrust in their body or their appetite, either verbally or non-verbally, plant seeds in their mind that there's something about my body that's wrong or that I can't trust. And I know for me, and I know for you potentially, if you've struggled with an eating disorder or a difficult relationship with food in your body, I guarantee that you can remember a time in your life as a child where you received that message that something about your body or your appetite was wrong. And so again, as a primary caregiver for your child, if you are able to support them by, you know, refraining from comments or again, any languaging or any nonverbal cues that might be conveying this message that you don't trust their body or that you're displeased with how they're eating, when we can avoid that, that serves as a huge protective mechanism for them and really goes a long way in decreasing their overall risk of developing an eating disorder. Okay, the third one here that I want you to consider is learning to respect and honor your child's autonomy and, you know, essentially giving them control over their body. And what does this look like, practically speaking, especially around mealtimes? Well, essentially, you know, this is really important at mealtimes in particular, because it's easy for us to become the gatekeeper of what our kids are eating or how much they're eating. And again, it's really easy to engage with our kids from our own hidden agendas and to engage in feeding practices with them that can subtly project the message that we don't trust them or we are not giving them full control of their own bodies. And so in order to, again, preserve the innate intuitive eating abilities they have, it's really important to focus on doing our jobs with feeding and trusting our kids to do their part with eating, essentially giving them autonomy and control over their bodies. And I always feel like I have to make sure I clarify what I'm saying when I talk about this type of point or this topic. And I'm not saying that we should just leave the full responsibility of feeding onto our kids, meaning, you know, that we should just give them free rein of the fridge and pantry and just kind of let them figure out what to eat all day long. That's definitely not what I'm saying and not what I'm promoting by asserting this idea of, you know, giving our kids autonomy over their bodies, because conceptually our kids oftentimes need our leadership, you know, when it comes to putting a meal together or figuring out like points to take breaks during the day and eat. And especially if you're raising neurodivergent children who may be more easily distracted or maybe harder for them to stop what they're doing to engage in feeding their bodies, you know, it's really important that as parents, we take that leadership role in providing food and offering a balance of food regularly throughout the day for our kids. Within that context and within that supportive, flexible structure, we want to give our kids full autonomy to decide what they want to eat from the foods that we are providing them and trusting them. This is where that trust piece again comes in so key. It's trusting our kids, even if it looks like them just eating the dessert portion from the meal off their plate or just having bread and not eating anything else. You know, this is where it's really important to be aware of the discomfort or distress that's coming up for you around how your child's eating and really being aware and conscious of any hidden agendas that may be, again, informing your feeding practices and your feeding engagements with your child. Because ultimately, we want to be able to center our child's autonomy. And that is, again, so important to preserving their innate intuitive eating abilities. And really, when we can do that, we are supporting them in decreasing their risk of having an eating disorder down the road. And when they can learn to listen to their body, that really does help them internalize this belief that their body can be trusted as the best expert of what they need. And that is such a powerful protective mechanism for diet culture, which is always purporting this idea that you can't trust your body or that you have to be looking for external rules or guidelines in the form of a diet to tell you how to eat versus being able to actually listen to your own body. And that's what we we want to avoid, because what we see from research is that dieting is the number one predictor of new eating disorders in children, particularly pre-adolescents and adolescents. And so in order to, you know, prevent our children from going down that route of having to look at diets or external rules or guidelines to inform their eating decisions, we again want to center their body autonomy and help them trust that their body is the best expert of what they need. And we trust that even if it doesn't feel like we can trust it, or we feel uncomfortable seeing the food choices that our child is making within the food parameters or what we're providing them. So again, a lot of these things definitely come back to us as parents and what we are doing, what we're thinking, what's coming up for us. And again, that's why it's really important to just have gentle awareness and curiosity about what's coming up for you in feeding your children, and learning how to deal with that discomfort versus projecting it onto your children can really go a long way in communicating these trust messages that they can then internalize for themselves. So that's a key point there. Point number four here is aiming for positive family meals or positive eating interactions with your children. And this is really centering on the connection piece. You know, so trust is a big piece, and connection, like building this relationship with our child, especially around feeding interactions, can be so powerful too. And there has been several studies around this, and one particular study of over 13,000 pre-adolescents found that family meals was one of the most effective strategies for decreasing a child's eating disorder risk. And don't think it's so much about like family meal or the meal looking a certain way, but more so just being able to connect and engage with your child and having kind of a responsive feeding interaction with your kids. You know, I think that it's easy to take this and again, formulate checklists or feel like, oh my gosh, my family meals have to look a certain way, and putting all this undue pressure on yourself about what your family meals need to look like. And it's just important to be aware and careful of going down that route, because sometimes we're so bogged down with our own expectations or arbitrary guidelines of what we think family meals should look like, that it becomes stressful for us. And, you know, when we're stressed out, our kids are picking up on that, and then it's feeling stressful for them. And so it's really important to understand that family meals can look like whatever they need to look like for your family. And this doesn't involve a prescriptive guideline in terms of what you need to be eating. You know, honestly, like sharing a pizza together on your living room floor as a picnic is going to be healthier for everyone in your family than stressing out over, you know, I need to make this perfect homemade meal and everything needs to be organic and I need to have so many servings of fruits and vegetables and everyone needs to be sitting down. Like, that becomes more stressful. So it's not so much about like the quality of the food, but more so about what are your family's interactions like? What are your engagements like together as a family? Do you feel like you're connecting with your child? And again, having that connection piece and creating positive associations around food and eating, no matter what that looks like for your family, can go such a long way in terms of decreasing your child's risk of developing an eating disorder. And again, I think sometimes when we think of family meals, we automatically think of dinner for some reason, but please give yourself permission to make that look like whatever it needs to for your family. I know for a lot of families, sometimes getting together and eating together as a family at dinner can feel impossible because of everyone's schedules, or you might have kiddos that have practice later in the evening or different activities. And so having family dinner can just feel like, man, this is a hit or miss. But it doesn't mean you can't try other meals or different eating times, or maybe on the weekends, like, you know, getting together the family for brunch or something more casual. Like, do it in a way that feels seamless and fits into your own family rhythms. And again, don't feel like you have to compare yourself to what other people are doing. It's really important to figure out what works for your family and your individual needs. And by doing that, it's more likely that you're going to create an environment for your family that feels more positive overall. So that's a big one there too. Okay, this last one is kind of a big topic, and it's actually 2 points, and I kind of lumped it into one. And honestly, I feel like I could do a podcast episode on each of these. So again, if either of these topics are resonating with you and you're wanting to hear more information, definitely connect with me and let me know. I'd love to create more resources for you around these topics. But two big things, again, in this last point here that are important in supporting our children's healthy relationship with food and decreasing their risk of developing an eating disorder are educating our kids around media, so media literacy, and also emotional regulation. So I'm going to touch on these briefly, but again, if you're interested in hearing more about these topics, let me know and we'll definitely put some more content together around these for you. But first one here is just helping our kids understand about media, right? Like becoming media literate, understanding that a lot of the images that they're seeing, things that they're seeing on social media, the influence of filters and photoshopping and, you know, diet, the diet culture industry in general, fat phobia, like these are all things that are really important to educate our kids about. And of course, we want to do it in a way that they can understand conceptually. So we might have to alter this depending on the ages of our kids, but we can definitely start sowing seeds and just helping them understand the broader context in which they're growing up. And in that way, it really helps them build resilience to diet culture and to diet culture messages. Because again, having an idea that we can just shield our kids from diet culture and just keep them in this little bubble, which I wish we could sometimes, like, but that's just not a reality. And instead, we want to inform them, we want to educate them, we want to empower them to become resilient to these messages. And really by educating them kind of gradually over time can really help them identify, you know, reality from arbitrary standards that diet culture is creating, especially around bodies and highlighting a certain body type as the only body type that's acceptable, you know, helping them see and be able to call out things like fat phobia and weight stigma. Those are going to be really powerful things for them, especially when they start to grow up and move outside of the context and safety of your own home. You know, arming them with this information can be really, really powerful for our kids. And so that's a big category there. It's just, you know, teaching our kids, educating them, and developing their media literacy. Another one under this category, I mean, I lump them together, but I really think this is a whole separate one in itself, but it's really supporting our kids with emotional regulation. So studies have found that individuals with eating disorders really have much more difficulty in perceiving, processing, and coping with various emotions. And individuals with eating disorders do often struggle with being chronically dysregulated or dissociated or disengaged and not having effective coping mechanisms to help support them with the inevitable dysregulation that comes up in our lives. This is part of being human, right? And the goal is not to somehow prevent our kids from ever feeling dysregulated. We just want to help them build skills to learn how to regulate through various emotional states. And this can be a really challenging one for many reasons. And one primary one being is most of us did not grow up having this modeled. A lot of us, this is really common, grew up where, you know, emotions or certain emotions like sadness or anger or frustration were, you know, looked as negative things and something that we shouldn't somehow show our emotions. And a lot of us did not feel safe to show certain emotions, or we were never taught to effectively cope with them. And, you know, this is something that is generational for sure, right? And so this is an important piece in supporting our kids in learning a whole new way, like redeveloping an entirely new narrative around their emotional state and helping them build skills to effectively manage and cope through different emotions that may arise for them. And, you know, what's interesting too is that eating disorder behaviors often develop as an attempt at regulating a dysregulated nervous system. So many of us who grew up becoming dysregulated, but not having coping skills or safe outlets to process our emotions may have essentially developed these behaviors around food and our bodies in attempt to regulate the dysregulation that we're feeling. And while that is essentially a survival mechanism, it's also maladaptive, right? Like there's a lot of consequences to eating disorder behaviors, even though it may in the moment effectively help us. And for a lot of us, it can keep us stuck in chronic distress. And so we want to help our kids learn skills and tools, and we want to validate their emotions. And this is something that can be really powerfully done through our own relationship with our kids, and something that's really effectively done through what we call co-regulation, like us as parents learning to be attuned and responsive to our kids' emotional state and helping them work through emotions that they are experiencing. For a lot of us who have experienced trauma in different degrees, oftentimes trauma is internalized because there wasn't a safe person to witness or be with us through a difficult emotional state. We felt alone and therefore internalized shame around this particular experience or this particular emotion. And again, eating disorders fester off of shame. And so, you know, we have an opportunity essentially to rewrite the cycle again, to do differently or learn to do differently with our kids, where we can practice being that safe person for them that witnesses their pain and doesn't try to just dismiss it or brush it aside, but really is there with them as a safe person and helping them build skill sets that can help them cope effectively with the different emotional states that are inevitably going to come up for them as they grow up. And again, like I said, this is a really big one, but just some general ways or ideas that we can support our kids with this. Like one big one is just naming or narrating feelings that are coming up for them. So again, a lot of us may have grown up and have felt different things within our body, but didn't understand what we were feeling, right? And then being told things like stop crying or stop doing that, right? Because it was distressing to our parents or our caregivers, and they didn't know how to manage it, right? You see how the cycle continues here. But a lot of us like didn't even have that validation or naming of our emotional states. And so even now as adults, for many of us, it can be confusing. It can be kind of off-putting if we don't understand what we're experiencing and how that actually feels in our body. And so it can be really powerful to start practicing this with your own child and to just start naming what they're feeling in a gentle way. Like, I see that you're sad, you know, and I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I'm here for you. Mommy's here for you. And I'm here. If you want, I can give you a hug. We can hold on to your teddy bear, you know, and of course you want to adjust it so that it's age appropriate for your own child. But simply naming what they're feeling gives validation and gives them space to acknowledge what is coming up for them versus feeling like I have to shove this aside. I have to put this away. And again, a lot of us learn to do that in order to appease our caregivers or make other people around us feel more comfortable, when in reality, we needed safe spaces to be able to process those emotions that were coming up for us. So being able to do that for our kids can be a really powerful step with that. Other things that go along with this include just reframing thoughts, right? Like sometimes kids might say certain things, and just presenting a reframing of what they're saying can be really helpful. And also just, you know, extending self-compassion to ourselves, but also to our kids, I think is also really powerful. Like to just help them know, like, you're okay. What you're feeling is okay too. And just extending that compassion can be so important in supporting emotional regulation. And last kind of piece that I'll touch on here, but again, we can chat more about this in more depth, is just modeling and engaging in practices that support self-regulation and co-regulation with our kids, right? Like we want to think of what are some activities or things that really promote a felt sense of safety. And this is going to be highly individual based on your child, based on kind of their love language, what resonates with them. There's a lot of sensory integration in this piece too. So some kids like really learn to regulate emotion through different sensory input. Some kids are more auditory. some kids are more tactile, and different learning, different modalities that essentially work for your child can be really powerful. And to be able to model those things and engage in those things. I know this is one thing that I learned with my youngest when she was kind of going through a lot of emotional outbursts. And there's songs, she really loves the show Daniel Tiger. And there's a lot of like little songs on there that talk about like naming anger and working through anger. And we just learned and would sing some of those songs together when she was having a really hard time. But I realized for her that singing and like auditory, like hearing those words sung to her was really powerful. And, you know, a lot of this is trial and error, just kind of figuring out like what works, what resonates with your individual child can be, you know, really helpful. And just giving yourself a lot of grace, but knowing that this emotional regulation piece, again, when our kids learn that they are safe in their emotions, they're safe in their bodies. And when they develop this arsenal of tools to support them through different emotional states, it really can go such a long way in decreasing that risk for the eating disorder developing. So this is a really big one here too. And I do want to touch on just a couple things in regards to this particular topic of emotional regulation. One being that it can be really hard to attune to your own child or respond to your child if you have never had this modeled to you, which is so many of us. So if you feel like you're raising your hand, I was right there with you. Like, this is something that for me recently, and even in my own parenthood journey, was, you know, something I had to really dig into deeper, because it can be really hard to hold space for our own children when we didn't have caregivers who held space for us. And so a lot of this is reparenting. I'm huge about reparenting and learning to give our kids what we needed as children. And as we do that, it can be really healing for us. You know, and the other thing here too, to understand, is that it can be hard to co-regulate with your child if you yourself are constantly in a state of dysregulation. And so again, this is a whole nother topic that I feel like we can talk about. But if you feel like you're still struggling with an eating disorder or various maladaptive coping skills that are essentially making it hard for you to have capacity for your kids and their various big feelings and emotions that may come up, that does not make you a bad parent. That makes you human. And again, sometimes when we can shed light on these areas that need a little more TLC, it can give us a really clear roadmap in terms of ways that we can better help ourselves. And in essence, meeting those deeper needs that we had as children, but then also like being able to show up for our kids in a more powerful way. And therapy, counseling, support groups can all be helpful in being able to process these things and learn better coping skills for yourself as a parent. Because let's face it, like, motherhood is full of triggers and full of so many ups and downs that can put us in many constant states that feel like dysregulation. And if you don't know how to effectively manage that, or you feel like you're drowning, please know that you're not alone. And there are steps that you can take to better help yourself. So I hope this was helpful. I feel like, again, there's so much that we can talk about here, but I just wanted to share and just encourage you. And as always, like, know that you are doing so much to help support your child in a positive way. Don't ever doubt that. Again, like, you know, sometimes we just shoulder so much on ourselves to do differently for our kids because we love them and we want to show up differently for them. And we want to do everything that we can to support them around food and their bodies in a positive way. And so I just want you to be encouraged in knowing that you are making a difference in your child's life. And again, all these things I talked about, I don't want you to feel like you have a whole list of things to do, but rather just kind of lean in with curiosity and hone in on those areas that are really resonating with you, and just focus on one baby step at a time, and knowing that going at a pace that works for you is also important to honor your capacity and where you're at in life. But as always, I am sending you so much love. Thank you again for being here. And please feel free to reach out via email, hello@crystalcargis.com, if you have any questions. Otherwise, I will see you next week, Mama. Thank you for listening to this week's episode of the Lift the Shame podcast. For more tips and guidance on your motherhood journey, come connect with me on Instagram @crystalcargis. Until next week, Mama, I'll be cheering you on. Bye for now.